Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
After a major Supreme Court ruling, Florida's lawmakers and judges are wrangling over how to change the state's capital sentencing system.
Mr. McClain wants to reduce every sentence to life. The state wants to say this is the narrowest ruling ever.
Also tonight, an emotional plea for relief comes from family and friends of a former Florida State University football player who died 15 years ago.
And I want to believe that our word has honor, that we will finally do what is right and agreed to 15 long years ago.
We'll also talk about an exception to the Sunshine Law that has local governments happy, a quick confirmation for the state's prison chief, and the possible decrease of protections for the state's official marine mammal. I'm Tom Flanagan at Day 2 of Week 4 of the 2016 Florida Lawmaking Session. This is Capitol Report. Florida's 389 death row inmates are in limbo after the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated the state's capital sentencing system. Nick Evans reports the top court in Florida has to decide if the ruling applies retroactively.
Kerry Michael Lambrix was sentenced to die February 11th. Tuesday afternoon, the Florida Supreme Court issued a stay on his sentence. His lawyer, Marty McClain, says executions need to wait until the ruling in Hearst v. State of Florida plays out. In that case, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled Florida's death sentencing system violates the Sixth Amendment. That's because juries only recommend the death penalty, and then a judge decides whether to impose the sentence. McClain argues the Hearst ruling needs to apply retroactively.
If this court doesn't apply it retroactively, it's going to create an Eighth Amendment issue in terms of the arbitrary manner in which people get the benefit of Hearst.
When the Supreme Court renders a decision that results in a new rule of constitutional law, that finding is supposed to apply retroactively. But another case, Ring v. Arizona, doesn't, because that ruling was simply a matter of procedure. That's the argument Scott Brown from the Attorney General's office opened with, but he didn't get far.
Hearst announced a new procedural rule holding Ring applicable to Florida, but it was a very narrow procedural ruling.
You know, here's the problem that we're
That's Justice
have.
Barbara Periente cutting him off, and she goes on.
Mr. McClain wants to reduce every sentence to life. The state wants to say this is the narrowest ruling ever. I think we have to come up with something that is actually what Hearst holds and what the Florida statute is. So if the state is really going to go the other extreme, we're not going to have a very helpful oral argument.
To support his argument, Brown read from an earlier ruling against retroactivity. It's a ruling penned by Justice Fred Lewis, one of the judges sitting on the bench.
Ring cannot be classified as being of fundamental significance or sufficient magnitude to warrant retroactive application.
We can be wrong.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
We can be wrong.
Well, Your Honor, you have
to. You have to be big enough to admit.
While the Supreme Court considers what to do with existing death row inmates, the legislature is working on changes for the capital sentencing system moving forward. House lawmakers are pushing a plan requiring 9 of 12 jurors recommend a death sentence. But Ocoee Democrat Randolph Bracey says the death penalty is applied unevenly, and requiring unanimity throughout the process might reduce racial disparities.
No white person has ever been sentenced to death for killing a black victim in the state of Florida. As I said, there's great variation in how the death penalty is being applied. So one way to reduce the bias is to require unanimous juries when recommending the death penalty.
But Brandon Republican Ross Spano defends the proposal. He says juries will have to unanimously find defendants guilty and then unanimously agree on an aggravating factor.
And then once you get past that, you have to have 9 of the 12 jurors indicate that there is no mitigating circumstance that outweighs that aggravating factor. And then beyond that, the judge can still depart downward.
The measure passed and now heads for the House floor, but court watchers warn there's a trend toward unanimity in capital sentencing, and Florida could find its new proposal back before the Supreme Court soon. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Every year, lawmakers file dozens of claims bills for residents who have been harmed by organizations backed by the state. But very few of these bills are ever funded. This year is no exception. But as Lynn Hatter reports, two lawmakers, along with some former NFL football players, are hoping to change the fate of at least one of those bills.
It was a late February day in 2001. Devon Darling had just finished running a grueling set of practice drills under the watchful eyes of his coaches. Darling collapsed. He was rushed to the emergency room, but he never woke up. The cause of death? Physical overexertion. Former FSU and NFL player Corey Simon was there the day Devon died. He helped comfort Devon's brother, Devard.
Didn't seem that long ago. And I'm sure for this family, it's been 15 long years. I won't get into the politics of what this is. I'm here for DeBard, and I'm here for this family. And just like that day that I was there when this happened, and I'm going to always support them, and I'm going to always support him, because he's a brother. He's a brother at FSU, a university that we both attended, and one that I'm extremely proud of.
DeVard and Devon Darling were identical twins and teammates at FSU. Shortly after his brother's death, DeVard transferred to Washington State. He was later drafted by the Baltimore Ravens.
It's been a bittersweet relationship with Florida State ever since that's happened, since February 26, 2001. And it's a day that I'll never forget.
DeVard created the As One Foundation, which provides young athletes with scholarships and summer camps. As the story goes, no one realized when DeVard was born that he had a twin. And it wasn't until he emerged with his brother, Devon's hand gripping his ankle, that doctors and his surprised parents knew. According to the foundation's website, doctors claimed the oversight must have been because the twins' hearts were beating as one.
DeVard founded the organization. It was born out of the loss of his brother, Devon, and hence the name As One, and two hearts beating as one. And so they had some goals and some dreams, like as twins share in their own little private moments, and then they sometimes share with their siblings and the family, or what we're going to do, what we accomplish this, and when we get there. In the journey to that, Devon died, and instead of it turning out to be a bad thing, and most people's idea would be a tragedy, but instead of it turning out to be a tragedy, it turned out to be a good thing, and that's how As One Foundation was born, in part.
I want to believe that our humanity is not lost. I want to believe that our compassion endures. And I want to believe that our word has honor, that we will finally do what is right and agreed to 15 long years ago.
Tampa Democratic Senator Arthenia Joyner has carried a claims bill for the Darling family for 7 years. She says former Tallahassee Senator Al Lawson pushed the bill for 5 years before that. The legislation has languished in the Florida legislature for 12 years. Florida State University inked a settlement deal with the Darling family for $2 million in 2004. But state sovereign immunity laws only allowed the university to pay out $200,000. The legislature has to award the rest. And Joyner and House co-sponsor Representative Mia Jones are calling on the chairs of the first reference committees, Senator Miguel Diaz de la Portilla and Representative Kathleen Pasadomo, to take up the bills.
And I said to her, I know that you are a woman who has a heart. I said to her, I know that you understand what being a mother is. And I simply asked her to put herself in Miss Wendy's shoes and to give justice to Devon, give justice to this family, and to allow the Darling family to put an end after 15 years to this torturous journey that they've been on.
Devon Darling died at 18. The wait for lawmakers to approve a claims bill for the family will have taken the majority of the time he was alive. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, local governments want a bit of shade from Florida's Sunshine Law, and that puts them at odds with open government defenders.
I was just curious what tactic you would use that prevents raping the treasury of our small towns from their already hard fought for tax dollars that are necessary for them to function.
While Florida's prison chief breezed through another confirmation hearing, some lawmakers still had concerns.
My concern about that is I think there are some systemic issues in the department that need to be fixed, and it seems like we're just reappointing all the same directors with one exception.
And as Florida's manatee population increases, something protection like no-wake speed zones should decrease.
There's only about 50 to 70, maybe upwards of 80 manatees killed by boat strikes every year.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org.
Local governments scored another victory today when a House panel approved a measure sponsors are calling public records law reform. But First Amendment advocates warn it will mean the end of government in the sunshine, as we hear from Jim Ash.
Even its staunchest defenders admit Florida's legendary public records law has a loophole. Nobody asked to tell the city of Gulfstream, where scam artists have filed 2,500 phony public records requests and 46 lawsuits over the past 2 years.
The fees for lawyers for their small town of 900 people have gone from $35,000 a year to over $1 million a year just in attorney's fees to deal with one law firm who keeps inundating them with public records requests.
That was Republican Representative Greg Stube of Sarasota describing the problem Tuesday to the House Government Oversight Appropriations Subcommittee. Stube's proposal to fix the problem is simple. By changing shall to may, he would give judges a choice about whether to award attorney's fees to people who sue for public records. But critics, like AFL-CIO lobbyist Rich Templin, calls it a disaster. Every year, open government advocates skirmish with lawmakers over exemptions for specific records. This is much more fundamental, Templin says.
Each session when you come and you provide more exemption from the Sunshine Law, more exemption of records, more exemptions of meetings, that cherished institution is being diminished. This legislation is actually a cut to the jugular.
First Amendment Foundation President Barbara Peterson acknowledges the law is being abused.
The bad actors on the access side of the aisle, the gotcha guys, do harm to us, to the people who are trying very hard to get access to public records.
But she says the threat of attorney's fees is the only stick a citizen has when he asks a government official to hand over public documents. And that's the real flaw in public records laws, Peterson says.
So the citizens in your communities who have been wrongfully denied access to a public record have no alternative other than filing suit. And we would very much like to see an enforcement mechanism, a middle step where we go before we go to court.
Peterson isn't the only expert advocating change. Keith Rizzardi is a St. Thomas University law professor. Rizzardi handled public record suits when he worked for the South Florida Water Management District. He supports the bill, and he thinks it could go even further. People wouldn't use the public records law like an ATM if it included a so-called reciprocal attorney fee provision, Rizzardi says. Open meeting laws already work that way, he says.
There are provisions in the Government in the Sunshine Law where we say that a person who improperly brings a government and sunshine law case can be exposed to attorney's fees and might have to pay attorney's fees to the government.
Representative Charles Van Zandt of Palatka seemed to speak for most conservative Republicans on the committee. He's eager for a change, and he wants to see it soon.
I was just curious what tactic you would use that prevents raping the treasury of our small towns from their already hard fought for tax dollars that are necessary for them to function.
The bill passed the committee with only a single negative vote. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
The head of the Florida Department of Corrections received unanimous approval during her second Senate confirmation hearing, as we hear from Sasha Cordner.
With just 7 minutes left in their two-hour meeting, members of the Senate Criminal Justice Committee breezed through the confirmation hearing for Prison Chief Julie Jones. She's been in her role for about a year. Her agency has been under scrutiny for inmate deaths, allegations of abuse by prison guards, and cover-ups.
I don't think it's any secret that there are problems at the Department of Corrections, and I know your basic goal has been to fix some of those things, but I have a few concerns that I wanted to ask you about.
Some solutions have been looking into making some leadership changes, which Lake Ward Democratic Senator Jeff Clements further questioned.
And the first deals with the hiring of the new regional directors, which are seemingly really kind of the old regional directors. We moved the director from Region 1 to Region 2. We moved the director from Region 2 to Region 1. We have a regional warden from Region 2 going to Region 3. And a warden from Sewanee going to direct Region 4. And my concern about that is I think there are some systemic issues in the department that need to be fixed, and it seems like we're just reappointing all the same directors with one exception. Can you speak to that?
And while Jones acknowledged the internal hire, she says she tried to look for outside people.
We interviewed multiple people outside the agency, and they were either not qualified or, when approached for a job, they declined the job because there was a better job offered elsewhere. So we did look outside the agency and interviewed multiple people outside the agency before I made the selections internally.
And she adds she also looked at a number of other factors.
And I weighed a lot of information based on what I know about the individual, their work record, and my expectations for my employees and what I believe that they were going to do for the department through my leadership. And having a solid basis of knowledge for the department was also key, and state government and the desires of this committee and others, and as opposed to bringing someone in totally cold.
But Jacksonville Democratic Senator Audrey Gibson says she applauds Jones' leadership moves. Gibson adds while she understands Clement's position, she feels this is a step in the right direction.
I wanted to see movement in terms of separating some folks from the folks that they have supervised over the years or worked with over the years, because I believe that that could help with the culture. And so in terms of reassigning some of those, the regional directors, I think they're called, I see that as a more of a positive than not. And I do believe that it's a little bit difficult to engage people to want to come inside of an institution that's kind of doesn't have a really good reputation right now.
Fixing understaffing levels is among Jones' priorities. She's also in the process of moving correctional officers from 12-hour shifts to 8-hour shifts, which Gibson likes as well.
8-hour shifts gives more people opportunities to be off and be with their families, and I think that would be a great improvement. I feel like we're kind of going in slow motion, though, and I hope that the shift change will help with the culture, too. And if you find that it doesn't help, that you will move not just those regional directors around, but some of the correctional staff as well, not pointing any fingers at anyone. But I think there are still some systemic changes that need to be made to get us to where we need to be.
And Jones says she'll keep those concerns in mind. In the last few seconds of the committee, one correctional officer tried to address lawmakers about what she called the, quote, ticking time bombs within the department, but there was no time. So with the backing of the Florida Prosecuting Attorneys Association as well as the Florida Smart Justice Alliance, all five members of the Senate Criminal Justice Committee voted to confirm her. According to Baker Republican Greg Evers, the panel's chair, Jones' ultimate confirmation hearing will be in the Senate Ethics and Elections Committee, and he agreed to speak one-on-one with the correctional officer after the meeting to hear her concerns. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kordner.
For many people, interactions with law enforcement can be stressful, but for people who have difficulty communicating, these simple interactions can lead to grave misunderstandings. Kate Payne reports some lawmakers are trying to make those interactions safer.
You're driving down the road, maybe a hair over the speed limit, when you hear those sirens. It's the cops. We all know that sinking feeling. But imagine if you can't hear those sirens. For the deaf and hard of hearing, miscommunication with the police is a real concern. But some state lawmakers are trying to fix that. Representative Victor Torres of Orlando wants to mark driver's licenses with a symbol signifying the driver is deaf.
This symbol on the license will alert the officer to the fact that the driver is hard of hearing or deaf and assist them when identifying how to best communicate with the driver.
Academy Award winner Marley Matlin of West Wing fame is working to educate people on deaf rights. Matlin herself is deaf and is also married to a police officer. Here she is speaking through an interpreter.
Getting stopped by the police, even at a routine traffic stop, can often be a scary experience. For those of us who are deaf or hard of hearing, it can be even scarier. When officers often don't realize we can't hear them, it can lead to confusion or worse.
From Michael Brown in Ferguson to Freddie Gray in Baltimore, law enforcement incidents dominate the news. June McMahon is the vice president for the Florida Association of the Deaf. McMahon says these interactions between officers and deaf people can get out of hand. Here she is speaking through an interpreter.
An officer might speak and the deaf person literally doesn't even know they're being spoken to, or they misunderstand what's being said. Or sometimes you might have a deaf person and perhaps there's an officer behind them yelling at them to stop walking. And the deaf person is ignoring them, not because they're in fact ignoring them. They don't even know they're being spoken to because they can't hear.
In certain cases, deaf people may be arrested and handcuffed. Even if they cooperate, June McMahon says this can be debilitating for people who use sign language.
Yeah, I mean, it's a situation that's becoming really, really difficult. When a deaf person is cuffed, they can't communicate. Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, it's never happened to me, but if it were to happen to me, I wouldn't even be able to think straight. I can't even imagine.
Some interactions between police and deaf people end violently. Robert Kim, Pearl Pearson, and Jonathan Meister all attempted to alert officers they were deaf, but because of the communication barrier, they were misunderstood and physically attacked by the police. Representative Mike LaRosa of St. Cloud says the bill could prevent these kinds of issues.
This is a real issue, and I've got a lady in my district, and I think you know who she is, who's given me some examples of kind of what she's gone through, just a little bit antagonized, and it's kind of hard to understand. And when you put yourself in their shoes, when they do get pulled over or they're in a circumstance where they need to identify that they can't hear, it's going to be very intimidating on their part.
The House Highway Safety Subcommittee passed the bill unanimously Monday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Another busy day faces lawmakers at midweek, and here's a packed preview from Ronald J. Eben, and gives us a packed preview of Wednesday's legislative action.
State budgets will be up for discussion Wednesday morning. The House Appropriations Committee takes up the proposed House budget at 8 a.m. The Senate Appropriations Committee is slated to consider the Senate's proposed budget package at 9. The Florida League of Cities Legislative Action Days breakfast will be held at 7:30 tomorrow morning. The Florida County Council on the Social Status of Black Men and Boys will conduct a conference call from 9 till 11. The House holds a floor session at 3 p.m. Governor Scott, Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam, Senate President Andy Gardner, and Senator Jack Latvella are expected to be among the speakers during the Association of Counties Legislative Days event to be held at 9 a.m. at the Turnbull Center on the campus of Florida State University. And Gardner is scheduled to speak at 6 p.m. at the Governor's Club. The Florida Supreme Court will hear arguments in three cases tomorrow, including an appeal by death row inmate Dante Harris, who was convicted in 2010 of the killing of Tampa police officers David Curtis and Jeffrey Kocab. Those are some of the highlights in the 2016 legislative session for Wednesday, February 3rd. I'm Ronald J. Eben.
Finally tonight, while wildlife officials discuss downgrading manatees from endangered to protected animals, one lawmaker says he'd like to look into removing special no-wake zones that were put in place to protect the animals. Regan McCarthy has more.
Florida's manatee population has grown from little more than 1,000 in 1991 to more than 6,000 in 2015. And U.S. wildlife officials say that's a sign it could be time to remove Florida's sea cows from the endangered species list.
Last month, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed that the West Indian manatee be downlisted from endangered to threatened status under the Endangered Species Act due to a reduction in direct threats to the animal and its habitat.
That's Republican Representative Larry Ahern of Seminole. He's behind a bill that would launch an independent count of the manatees and would commission a study on the impact of removing special manatee no-wake zones. Typically, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission conducts population counts, but officials say manatees are counted as scientists see them, sometimes during flyovers. And the FWC admits the number of manatees is likely higher than the count, since officials can only include the animals they see. Ahern is hoping for what he calls a more scientific process and wants an update by 2019. He says sometimes the state agency's counts can take too long.
It takes a couple of years typically for them to get that together. This will be a third party is the reasoning here, so that maybe it's a little more independent kind of a count that way.
Ahern says if manatees are no longer endangered, it makes sense no-wake zones should become scarce. But he says officials are creating more speed zones in his area. And he questions the role boats play in manatee deaths.
There's only about 50 to 70, maybe upwards of 80 manatees killed by boat strikes every year versus about 400 that are due to red tide or natural causes.
Meanwhile, citizens like John Fansteel say they want to make the most of Florida waters without so many limitations.
It's wonderful looking out over the cove and seeing kids water skiing and tubing. And they're doing it under the watchful eye of their parents. They're not inside getting high or playing video games. They're out enjoying physical activity in the Florida waters. FWC says water sports have to stop in our cove, even though there's no manatees there. There's not even any seagrass there because it's a deep cove.
Fansteel says officials have created no-wake speed zones in his cove, despite limited sightings of manatees in the area. Ahern's measure passed the House Agriculture and Natural Resource Committee Tuesday. A similar bill in the Senate is awaiting its first hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again each weeknight during the 2016 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.